Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Karen Ornstein of Friends of the Earth, who takes a critical look at the recently announced U.S.-China agreement on carbon reduction and climate change. Longtime environmental movement activist James Gus Speth, who explains why he believes that America's failed politics and runaway consumerism is the root cause of environmental decline. And Craig Aaron of the media reform group Free Press, who examines President Obama's recent public advocacy for net neutrality and the role public activism can play in deciding the final outcome of this policy debate. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
As the United States escalates its offensive against ISIS militants, the United Nations reports nearly 14 million people have fled the conflicts in both Syria and Iraq. More than 7 million people have been displaced within Syria, with another 3 million Syrians fleeing to other countries. In Iraq, nearly 2 million people have been displaced by fighting between ISIS and Iraqi and Kurdish forces. At the same time, refugees have fewer places to seek safe haven as neighboring countries Turkey and Jordan are closing their borders. The International Rescue Committee and the Norwegian Refugee Council have called on Western governments to take in larger numbers of Syrian refugees. Over the last 3 years, only 7,000 refugees have been allowed to enter Western countries, while over 1.6 million Syrians have poured into Turkey seeking refuge. Jan Egeland of the Norwegian Refugee Council warned that neighboring countries are filled to the brim with desperate Syrians, more than 3 million people. Hundreds of thousands are now massing on the border areas with no escape. Inside Turkey, Syrian females fleeing the country face growing threats of abuse. Young women and girls are often targeted for sexual exploitation. The United States Agency for International Development, USAID, is changing its rules affecting future covert operations in response to fierce criticism of the development agency's secret program in Cuba to establish a Twitter-like service with the goal of undermining the island's communist government. An investigation by the Associated Press uncovered the secret Cuban Twitter program, known as Zunzaneo, slang for a Cuban hummingbird's tweet, and detailed how USAID and its contractor had secretly routed funding through the Cayman Islands. USAID's more restrictive rules mirror legislation that was introduced last summer in the U.S. Senate that bars the agency from spending money on democracy promotion programs in nations that reject cooperation with the development agency or from using contractors to carry out covert programs. Washington's so-called pro-democracy programs will be transferred to other bureaus in the U.S. State Department and the National Endowment for Democracy. During hearings last summer, Senators Patrick Leahy of Vermont and Jeff Flake of Arizona blasted the existence of the secret Cuban Twitter project. Senator Leahy praised the new rules for the agency, stating, "USAID is a development agency and its program should be open and transparent, not covert." He continued, "Nothing illustrates this more tragically than the continued imprisonment of Alan Gross in Cuba." Gross, an American contractor working with USAID, was arrested in December 2009 for smuggling sensitive technology into Cuba, and he was sentenced to 15 years in prison. California's Central Valley is home to a boom in almond cultivation. Driven by a growing appetite for the healthy nuts, almond production has doubled since 2005. Yet almond trees consume large amounts of water, even as California officials are taking strong measures to address the state's severe drought. Although most almond farms are family-run, Mother Jones magazine reports a rapid increase in investment dollars flowing to the region from institutional investors. TIA CREF, the retirement fund with $500 billion in assets, now owns 37,000 acres of California farmland and is one of the world's top almond producers. The combination of California's three-year drought and expanded nut production has led to a steep drop in the Central Valley's groundwater levels. Between 2003 and 2010, the valley's aquifers lost a total of 20 cubic kilometers of groundwater, enough to meet the household water needs of New York City for 11 years. Water experts predict the American West could be entering the early stages of a decades-long mega drought. Water quality is also declining in many farming communities as the presence of salt and arsenic has increased to unsafe levels. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
Just 1 week after the Democratic Party suffered a string of midterm election defeats, including losing control of the U.S. Senate, President Obama made a joint announcement with Chinese President Xi Jinping in Beijing, outlining a plan to reduce the carbon emissions of both nations, with the goal of boosting the chances for a successful international climate agreement in Paris in December 2015. The non-binding agreement, as described by Mr. Obama, would aim to cut U.S. carbon emissions by 26-28% below 2005 levels by the year 2025. Mr. Xi pledged that China would reach peak carbon emissions by 2030 and would build a new generation of green power sources to supply 20% of the nation's energy needs by the year 2030. Just a few days later, while at the G20 summit meeting in Brisbane, Australia, Mr. Obama announced that the U.S. would contribute up to $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund to assist developing nations adapt to climate change. Not surprisingly, Republican leaders criticized the U.S.-China agreement, despite the fact that many in the party had long based their opposition to regulating carbon emissions at home, as long as major polluters like China and India refused to make similar commitments. Many environmental groups were also critical of the agreement, but for a very different set of reasons. They pointed out that the carbon reductions outlined are not legally binding and are nowhere near the cuts needed if the world is serious about preventing runaway climate change. Your reporter spoke with Karen Ornstein, senior international policy analyst with the environmental group Friends of the Earth. Here she assesses the U.S. carbon reduction agreement and the challenges ahead for the climate change movement.
I think the biggest take-home of the announcement, and it's really actually more of an announcement than an agreement because there's nothing binding to it. There's no legal nature. It's each country does what it wants. But I think the take-home is that it actually is not at all science-based. And while it has important political implications as far as climate change and justice and basic climate science, it's nowhere near the need it needs to be. So, you know, if we're talking about keeping the global temperature rise below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 2 degrees Celsius, which is sort of the bare minimum that we might have a safe outcome as a result of a change in climate, these numbers that the U.S. has put on the table, as well as China, they don't get us there at all. But it's an important political step. One of the reasons that many senators and representatives have said we can't act on climate change is because China hasn't acted on climate change. So what this does is removes that excuse for inaction.
If you would, talk about the gap between what science is telling us is required of governments around the world, especially large industrial nations like the United States and China, and what this agreement represents. What's the gap?
Oh, the gap is really gaping. So it depends on what you're trying to get at. There's so many different scenarios. Where are you trying to keep the temperature from rising 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is what Friends of the Earth International, Friends of the Earth U.S. has called for? Are you trying to do 2 degrees Celsius, 4 degrees, and also what percentage you're trying to have of probability, like 50% of chance of going over 2 degrees, 50% chance of going over 1.5 degrees? And if we really are trying to get to stay on a path that's much more aligned with justice and with climate science and with really keeping the planet in much more close of a form of what it is today, then you're going to try to aim for no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius with a great degree of probability. And if that's the case, you know, the reductions the U.S. have to make are pretty enormous. In fact, we would have to go into the negatives. And you could say, well, how do you have negative, you know, over 100% emissions reductions? Physically, you can't. So then you would actually have incredible steep reductions within the U.S. domestically, and then you'd also facilitate reductions in other countries. The numbers are really big and would require far greater levels of ambition than what we're seeing here.
Tell our listeners what, if anything, the consequences of these announcements from President Obama and the Chinese leadership, what kind of role will it play in coming international negotiations in Paris and some of the precursor meetings?
There's going to be a climate summit next month in Lima, Peru. And then throughout 2015, there's going to be a series of negotiations all culminating in Paris in December of 2015, where we're expecting a new global climate agreement. And in the White House statement, its announcement with China and about the Green Climate Fund talk about the injection of political momentum into the international process. And I think that's true. What these announcements have done is they really have injected a greater sense of momentum for the talks. Having the two largest current emitters of greenhouse gases announce commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions sort of sets the platform for other countries to start taking it more seriously, because the bar is set really low for the United States. So the fact that President Obama does anything that indicates in any way that he's serious about climate change and the United States is serious about climate change is a cause for applause around the world, whether or not that, again, is commensurate with need and with science. So what President Obama has put forward, again, is not commensurate with what's needed or with what science demands or with what climate justice demands, but it's the United States. So people are happy that we're doing anything aside from just denying climate change is real. And the Green Climate Fund in particular, the U.S. coming out with a $3 billion announcement will actually cause other countries to up their financial contributions to the Green Climate Fund, or actually their financial pledges. Because let's remember that, for example, in the case of President Obama, he announced the $3 billion pledge to the Green Climate Fund. And I think that, you know, it's a welcome step, but it's, you know, much more needs to be done. But it's up to Congress now to appropriate that money over the next couple of years. And that will be a real challenge. And we'll see how much capital the Obama administration expends to make sure that Congress delivers on his promise. That'll be another test for Obama.
That was Karen Orenstein, Senior International Policy Analyst with the environmental group Friends of the Earth. Find links to more analysis of the U.S.-China Carbon Reduction Agreement and information on climate change by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. James Gustav Gus Speth has been called the ultimate environmental insider for his founding roles in the Natural Resources Defense Council and the World Resources Institute, his chairing of the Council on Environmental Quality under President Jimmy Carter, and his leadership of the United Nations Development Program. He then went on to serve as Dean of Yale University's School of Forestry and Environmental Studies for 10 years. Speth currently teaches at the Vermont Law School. In recent years, he's been a critic of the large national environmental groups of which he was such an intrinsic part. Now 74 years old, Speth just published a memoir titled Angels by the River, in which he recalls his many years of activism, as well as his childhood in pre-civil rights South Carolina. He considers his 2011 arrest in front of the White House for protesting the Keystone XL pipeline as one of his proudest moments. Gus Speth was in New Haven, Connecticut on November 8th to accept the Thomas Berry Award, given jointly by Yale's School of Forestry and Divinity School. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with him about his view of what many environmental activists maintain is the incompatibility of laissez-faire capitalism and implementing corporate regulations necessary to protect our ecosystem and ensure the survival of life on planet Earth.
I think we have to ask ourselves now, again, afresh, what is an environmental issue? And the answer normally is, oh, well, it's air pollution and climate change, biodiversity. But what if the answer to an environmental issue is that it's any issue that really determines environmental outcomes. It's really any issue that affects whether we succeed. If you answer it that way, then you have to dig deeper and look at the root causes. And certainly our failing politics is a tremendous cause of environmental decline, and perpetually a cause of environmental decline. And this great social inequality and insecurity in the country, our runaway consumerism, our affluenza, our failure to really change our lifestyles, the sort of values, very materialistic values, and anthropocentric values, and values that focus on now and not tomorrow. These set of values that dominate in our culture, we ought to be challenging them. And so there's a whole list of things We ought to be building new corporate types, new structures for business, public-private hybrids, for-profit, not-for-profit hybrids, all kinds of co-ops, local banking, state banks, new types of finance that have a lot more democratic governance of the way our investments are going in the country. There's just a host of big, deep changes that we need to make. So what some of us are doing is trying to create new institutions and change old institutions so that we are actually promoting a deeper systemic change in the country that can lead to basically a new economy, an economy that really does give true and honest priority to people and to place and to planet. And we're determined to keep building the strength of these institutions and these ideas to the point that we begin to get some real momentum to change the system, to move to a next system. And we don't have to know everything about it, but we need to know the general directions of change. And I think we're getting a lot of good information and ideas on that.
Throughout the book, you talked about the need for a transformative change in existing capitalism, that the capitalism we have now is just completely out of control. It's heading for, you know, wealth for fewer and fewer people and poverty for so many more. Can we transform capitalism enough that it would still be capitalism and we could have, you know, a sustainable world? Or do we really need to move to a different system? Do we even need to go down that road? Does it matter what we call it? I mean, do you think that capitalism can be reformed enough to get us through this?
Well, it depends on what you mean by capitalism. I think what we need to think about is moving dramatically beyond the rapacious capitalism that we have today, this corporate, this consumerist capitalism that we have. And, you know, that one of the ways to do that is to really have much more democratic control over where capital is spent. There may still be investors in this world of the future, but the public would be the major part of the steering about where money is spent and where money is invested. We have a system now where the banks make all the decisions with a little bit of influence from government on infrastructure and things whenever that happens. But by and large, the decisions about making investment decisions are based on high financial returns by banks and the people who are seeking to make the investments through the banks. And we need a system where we recognize the tremendously high social and environmental returns that we could get from other investments. So we need a heavy democratic guidance for investment decisions. And that, you know, implies that we have to have effective government. We have to have a government that works. We have to have a government that's deeply democratic. So sometimes when I think about these issues, I say that we need to save our failing democracy first, because people are not going to trust government to make these big decisions if it's the government we have now. So we need government, but we're beginning to see a lot of hybrid arrangements, community investment corporations around the country, community development corporations, which are, you know, public institutions that are steering the development of their cities. So I think in the future, there should be a role for the market. I think we need to take back as citizens a lot of the things that have been commodified and taken away from us as commoners. But I can see a role for the market to do certain things, but it ought to be a heavily regulated market, one that's really regulated to act in the public interest. Right now, just on environmental issues, the uncompensated damages of corporate actions, this is on a global basis, are estimated to be over a third of corporate profits. So if they really paid for the damages that they were causing, it would consume more than a third of corporate profits. So this is not a market that is now managed for, you know, current and future generations.
That was James Gustav Gus Speth, a leading environmentalist and both an architect and critic of the U.S. environmental movement. His memoir, titled Angels by the River, was recently published by Chelsea Green. Find links to Speth's writings on the urgent need to develop a new sustainable economy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In an unexpected announcement from the White House, President Obama issued a statement on November 10th declaring his public support for net neutrality, a principle that all traffic on the Internet should be treated equally, where individuals and small startup companies will have their content delivered to the public at the same speed as powerful, wealthy corporations. In a videotaped statement, the president said, "We cannot allow Internet service providers to restrict the best access or to pick winners and losers in the online marketplace for services and ideas." The president now advocates placing regulation of the Internet under Title II of the Telecommunications Act, the same set of rules governing telecommunications utilities like landline telephones. Although Mr. Obama had pledged his support for net neutrality when first campaigning for the White House in 2007 and 2008, his actions in appointing two Federal Communications Commission chairpersons, Julius Genachowski and Tom Wheeler, who both refused to back the policy, called into question the president's commitment on the issue. The White House position changed after a federal court overturned FCC rules regulating the Internet in January, and almost 4 million people sent public comments to the FCC objecting to Chairman Wheeler's proposal to establish a tiered Internet system where fees paid would determine the speed at which content would be delivered. Now, with President Obama's public support for net neutrality, the coming fight will be between net neutrality activists and content providers on one side and telecom giants like Comcast, Verizon, AT&T, and other broadband providers on the other. Your reporter spoke with Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media reform group Free Press, who examines President Obama's recent public advocacy for net neutrality and the role public activism can play in deciding the final outcome of this policy debate.
You know, with the president's statement and position really does make a difference in this debate. And, you know, he didn't just give a speech or, you know, sort of say something where you had to read between the lines. They really came out with a strong and clear policy position, leaving no mystery at the FCC as to where the administration stands on this issue. We can wish they did it sooner. We can wish it didn't take this many years to get to a solution that a lot of us have been advocating for. But, you know, I think we have to thank the president in this instance because, you know, he really did step forward before the FCC was about to make some really bad rules and sent an unmistakable message that they should stop messing around and actually do what they should have done in the first place, and that is make sure that Internet users have the protection they need under the law.
When President Obama came out for net neutrality in his announcement after the election, what weight does he carry on the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which is in charge of making or remaking the rules around the Internet?
Well, in this case, the president really has a bully pulpit. The Federal Communications Commission is an independent agency. Technically, he can't tell them exactly what to do. But the president did appoint all five members of the commission. Three of them are Democrats, two of them are Republicans, and certainly his view and the White House view holds a lot of weight. So for the administration to weigh in so clearly and, you know, I think convincingly in this debate really upends the whole conversation and makes it very difficult for an FCC chairman that he appointed to take a dramatically different position than what the president has proposed.
Craig, I wanted to ask, what's the importance in your view of civil society jumping into action here to try and pressure the FCC, the White House, Congress, or whoever can have an impact on issuing some final rules that will ensure net neutrality, an issue that your group and many others have been working on very hard for years and years?
I mean, I think it's literally the only thing that will work. The only way to beat organized money is with organized people. That's Saul Alinsky, and I think it's still true, and it's definitely been true in the case of net neutrality. We would not still be having this debate. We would not be this close to actually winning this fight if it wasn't for unprecedented public involvement and public pressure. 4 million people have contacted the Federal Communications Commission on this issue. That's far more than have contacted the agency on any other issue in its history. And it has everything to do with organizing, mobilizing a really broad-based coalition that includes groups that care about technology like Free Press and the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Fight for the Future, Demand Progress, the Netroots organizations like Move On and Daily Coast and others who have been very, very outspoken on this. A whole range of innovative businesses, even venture capitalists, you know, a really broad cross-section, people who watch, a lot of people who watch John Oliver, they have weighed in at the FCC like never before, and that's what kept this issue in play, and I think ultimately convinced the president, by the time it reached his desk, that he had to weigh in, because there was so much pressure on one side, and I think it was notable that after this, you know, really pretty devastating election loss for the Democratic Party, that the first thing a lot of the groups that make up the Democratic Party's progressive base, the first issue they went out on was net neutrality. And I think that got the attention of the White House, and they realized that there were all these people out there who really care about the future of the Internet, representing millions and millions more, and those same people probably didn't show up a couple Tuesdays ago to vote in the election. So there is this has really become a major issue, and it finally got the attention of folks at the highest levels of government. And the president did, as far back as 2007, talk about this issue, talk about taking a backseat to no one on the issue of net neutrality. And, you know, maybe here in the final years of the Obama administration, they finally tried to live up to one of those promises. And, you know, and this is a pretty good one and a very important one. And I think that's partly why Tom Wheeler also will come around to the president's position. You know, Tom Wheeler, a very interesting guy, a veteran of the telecommunications industry. Back in the 80s and early 90s, he was the nation's top cable industry lobbyist. After that, he became the nation's top mobile phone industry, wireless industry lobbyist. And then he spent a number of years as a venture capitalist and investor. One of the things he invested the most in was the election of Barack Obama, where he raised about $700,000 for the president's campaign. He has to ask himself whether he wants to go into a hostile Republican Congress with nobody supporting him or with millions and millions of people at his back. And Tom Wheeler still has an opportunity to be a hero, or he continue to tinker and try to come up with a confusing plan that probably won't work, and then he can go up and face John Boehner and Mitch McConnell all by himself.
That was Craig Aaron, President and CEO of the media reform group Free Press. For more information on the group's net neutrality and media democracy campaigns, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.